My name is Brookins Beckett. I'm an alcoholic. Boy, y'all are beautiful. Some beautiful sick people sitting out there tonight. I'd like to thank the committee for asking me to come up and speak tonight. Jerry asked me when I was here last year, and he asked my wife, but unfortunately she couldn't be with us. She's the state Al-Anon delegate, and she has a meeting tomorrow in Byron at their state office, and she couldn't miss it. This lady sitting over here, Barbara, she'll have to be down there too because she's one of the coordinators. And but she sent you her best. Me? I'm a member of the Baldwin County Group of Alcoholics Anonymous in Millersville, Georgia. We meet five times a week, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at noon, and Sunday night and Tuesday night at 7. If you're ever in that area, give us a call and come by and see us. We're glad to have you. And my sobriety date is December 2nd, 1983. And for that, I'm very proud. There's nothing I've done. It's what this program and God has done for me to take the obsession to drink away by working the 12 steps, practicing the 12 dishes, and living in service work, the 12 concepts. See, we have 36 spiritual principles. We have 12 steps, 12 traditions, 12 concepts. And it takes all 36 for me to stay sober and have a complete program. And I hope you feel that same way. Because I don't think service work is for everybody. I think service work is only for those that want to stay sober. And it's kept me sober a long, long time. I was sponsored into service work, and I like to talk a lot about service work because it's very, very rewarding. And my sponsor that I had before I got out of treatment nearly 20 years ago, I met him, first night I met him, he said, I want you to start going to assembly and making. And I don't know what assembly is. So I said, why? He says, because I said so. If you write that down and look at it every day, you got it. Just because I said so. And I started going to assembly and started working in service work. And it helped keep me sober. I want to thank the committee for the nice mugs they put in the room, the handmade glazed mugs from a fellow named Cooper in this area that does pottery and stuff. Very, very pretty. I came up Wednesday, and we played a golf Thursday and played again today, and we're going to play again tomorrow. Just so many golf courses in so little time. Yeah. Mr. Holden won by 4 strokes today. And probably do the same thing tomorrow. I'm not very good, but I enjoy playing. And unfortunately, I still have some character bad defects. I don't play with me if you don't like profanity. Because sometimes there's no other words that will suffice for the feeling you have. Whew. I'm just proud to be here tonight. And I'm checking my time, Charles. See, so I won't go over. I don't know why I'm an alcoholic. I told you all I was an alcoholic a while ago, and you know, that tells you a lot about me already. It tells you I was a thief, a cheat, a con artist. I con manipulated and cheated people, and I'd done that for a long, long time, and I'd still be doing it if I was out there, if I wasn't dead. And I don't know why I'm an alcoholic. I don't look like an alcoholic, do I? No. Do I look like you? I don't look like no alcoholic. I've never seen any one of us that looked like an alcoholic until last year. I was at the Georgia State prepaid convention over in Athens, and I saw this woman look like an alcoholic to me, and I went up and started talking to her and found out she was an Al-Anon. Let me tell you, I joke about Al-Anons, but I love Al-Anons. I really do. Al-Anon saved my marriage. You're going to learn in a few minutes that my present wife, which is my third wife, was also my first wife. And I'm her first and fourth husband. Y'all keep it up or you need a scorecard to go along with that. Yeah, it's a soap opera. And we make these people sick as they can be. And they need to recover. And if you're sitting out there tonight and you're in a program of Alcoholics Anonymous and you got a spouse or child at home and they're not in a 12-step program, you better get them in one. Because you're going to have trouble down the road. I don't mean you might get divorced or anything, but if you work this program like you're supposed to, you're going to spend a lot of time in Alcoholics Anonymous. You're going to be out late at night sometime calling on these drunks, and that spouse is not going to understand. Because one thing, they want to know why in the hell you can get sober for those people up there, and you couldn't get sober for us. And they don't understand the disease of alcoholism. And it is a disease. And it don't run in my family. It gallops, man. I got three children. They all need this program, and I only got one daughter that's working it right now, and I hope by the grace of God she'll continue to work it. I can tell you, I don't know why I'm an alcoholic. The only thing I can think about is I was born in the middle of the Depression. And we couldn't afford to buy milk, so I was a breastfeeding. And the doctor put my mother drinking a couple of cans of beer a day because he said the yeast in the beer would stimulate her mammary glands and she would produce more milk. Now, I don't know whether that's scientific or not, but that's what she did. And you see, I was getting my milk and booze at the same time. And they tell me I was a happy baby. And then they weaned me. And I think I've been mad ever since about that. Yeah. But anyhow, I grew up in a good home. My daddy was a hard-working man, and he would take a drink every once in a while. He was civic-minded. He was always in clubs, and he was a Shriner and a Mason, and he was on the Board of Education. He was on the hospital authorities in these towns we were living in and stuff like that. And he would take a drink, a social drink. And my mother would have a cocktail every once in a while when they went out to a Shrine dance or something like that. And they were not alcoholics. They were good, hard-working people. My mother was a homemaker. And I got a sister that's 4 years younger than I am. And it's a trip to talk to my sister today. She's not an alcoholic. In fact, I don't think she's ever had a beer in her life or a drink of liquor. But we sit down and talk today, and we grew up in the same home, and we talk about things that happened. And she saw it one way, and I saw it another. It's diametrically opposite of what was going on in that house. And she's only been, when she was in the eighth grade, she decided she would be a medical technologist. She went to one college, graduated from Phi Beta Kappa. She's only been married to one man. She's got four kids, and they all college graduate and got good jobs. I don't know where she went wrong. She had good potential, but... But I started drinking, and that lady that I tell you is my first and third wife, and I'm her first and fourth husband. I moved from a small town to a smaller town in 1948, and I met this little lady about 2 weeks after I moved into town. And 15 minutes after I met her, I said, "I love you, and I'm going to marry you one of these days." I was 14 years old, and she was 12. A few days later, we started going together. And on Christmas Day came, and up until that Christmas Day, my drinking career had consisted of a few sips of beer out of a beer can and eggnog at Thanksgiving and Christmas. That was my total drinking career up until that day. But that afternoon, I took her present over to her house, and her mother and dad and aunt and uncle were sitting at the kitchen table drinking. They had a quart jar, had Mason on the side of it, had a steel lid on top of it. And Mr. Garner pushed that bottle across the table and said, "Boy, you want a drink?" I said, "Yes, sir, I'll take a drink." You got to remember, I never had a drink of liquor in my life until then. And I picked up that bottle and I took a sip out of it, took a drink out of it. And today I can even tell you what I chased it with. I don't know whether it was water, tea, milk, Coke. I just don't remember what I chased it with. But there's a couple of things I remember about that first drink. First of all, I remember what it smelled and tasted like. It smelled and tasted like something you would sit in to remove a tattoo. It was pretty horrible. But there's another thing I remember about that first drink. I remember how it burned my mouth, and when I swallowed, how it burned my throat and went down my esophagus to my stomach, and it was like a small explosion went off. And it went down through my legs and out through my toes and came up through my arms and out through my fingertips and up through my head and out through my ears. And I came together for the first time in my life. I walked in there, a scared 14-year-old kid, and all of a sudden, that fear was gone. I could talk to these adults sitting around that table. I could joke with them, and I felt warm inside. I felt kind of loose as a goose, you know. Yeah, God, it was such a good feeling. And I said, "Well, man, if one does this, two are better." Well, that was my social drinking between the first and second drink. I went ahead and took three more drinks, with a total of four drinks out of that bottle that day, that jar. Do I have to tell you what happened? I got drunk. Then what happened? I got sick. Knee walking drunk the first time I ever drank. Hugging that commode going, "Oh, God." You know? But you know, in Georgia, on a hot summer day, hugging that commode and saying that prayer ain't all bad. Whenever you get through throwing up in that commode, you can kind of lay your head over against that porcelain. It's kind of cool to your brow, you know. Done it many, many times. Many, many times. And do you know why I drank so much? It made the promises come true in my life. Charles read the promises a while ago. But drinking liquor made the promises come true in my life. I don't know whether you ever heard this before, but you're going to hear it tonight. When I drank liquor, I was going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. When I drank liquor, I didn't regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. When I drank liquor, I comprehended the word surrender and I knew peace. When I drank liquor, no matter how far down the scale I had gone, I would see how my experience can benefit others. When I drank liquor, that feeling of uselessness and self-pity disappeared. When I drank liquor, I lost interest in selfish things and gained interest in our fellows, especially the young ladies. When I drank liquor, self-seeking slipped away. When I drank liquor, my whole attitude and outlook upon life changed. When I drank liquor, fear of people and of economic insecurity left me. That's the reason I drank liquor. It made the promises come true in my life. But also the promises in making me alive today and all these things that happened to me since I've been sober. Ain't that a miracle? The miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. In high school, I played football, baseball, basketball, and ran track. And the reason I didn't play tennis and golf, we didn't have them. I played everything that had ball connected with it, and I drank all those times. And my girlfriend, who is my wife today, she's also my first one, don't forget. We used to love to dance. And we was going to dances. I was driving when I was 14, 15, 16 years old before I ever had a license. And we was going to dances, and we danced. And I kept my booze in the trunk of the car so those adults wouldn't know I was drinking. I'd sneak out to the car and get me a couple of drinks and get loose as a goose and dance. Man, I thought I was Fred Astaire sometime on that dance floor. And we had some good times when I was drinking. And she might, my wife, and even today, she'll have a drink if we go somewhere to a party or something, a social function. She'll have one, which I don't understand. Why would you have one drink? Anybody understand that? To me, that's alcoholic abuse. One drink, you know. And say something like, baby, would you like another? Oh, my, no, I'm beginning to feel this one. What in the hell are you drinking it for? Don't understand that. But anyhow, I drank all through high school. And I found out one thing about being on the football field. Just before that whistle blows, when that whistle blows, just before you kick off, we used to get butterflies in our stomach. You remember that saying, we got butterflies in our stomach? You know what that is, people? That's fear. That's what it is. And we found out if you took a couple of sips of moonshine liquor out of a medicine bottle that the water boy had us on some towels in a bucket, that you didn't have that fear when you went out on the football field. And you could play some football. And it did its trick to me. It got rid of the fear. And I thought I was the only one in the world that had fear in my life. See, you know, and I thought I was a coward because I had fear in my life. And I like to talk about this because maybe some of you out there are the same shape I was in. My wife used to tell me, she said, you never run from anything. Yeah, but honey, I have this fear. I'm 49 years old. I'm probably 6 months sober in the program, and I'm sitting on the side of the bed reading a non-conference-approved book one night, and it says, fear is a God-given instinct. God gave me the feeling of fear to protect myself. He gave it to everybody to protect ourselves. If we hadn't been given that feeling of fear, we probably wouldn't be here today because the saber-toothed tigers would have eaten our ancestors. But I thought I was the only one that had fear, see, because you guys are sitting in those bars talking about, I ain't scared of nothing or nobody. I didn't know y'all were lying, too. And I was. I was scared. I had fear. And I know today that courage is not the like of fear. It's courage is fear that said its prayers. I know that day. And I'm not afraid of fear today. I get fear for some time in my life today, but I got a program where I can handle it. So I don't fear fear today, and I'm not ashamed of fear anymore. And I can tell you when I'm fearful. I can tell you when I'm hurting. I can tell you when things are not going right in my life. I could never do that when I was out there drinking. I always had to put up this image that everything was fine. I had it together. I'm all right, thank you. I'm just fine. And I'll be a bowl of jelly inside. But today I can be honest with you. The big book says there's three things we must have. Honesty, open-minded, and willingness. To me, I think the most important one of those is willingness. We got to be willing to be honest before we can get open-minded. And that's the way it came to me. I had to be willing to do the do, or I couldn't get where I'm going, where I am. I'm going to tell you a little story about how I was when I drank. I went through stages. I guess a lot of us did. Different emotions. And this story is about two guys sitting in a bar in Atlanta drinking one afternoon. They had been there a couple hours drinking, and finally one of them turned to the other one and said, "You know, so this is a unique bar we're in." Said, "It's 22 stories tall, and because of the contour of the building, the air currents come down the street." Said, "You get up on top of this 22-story building, and you jump off, and you get down about the fourth floor, so the air currents will pick you up and set you down right where you jumped off." Second guy said, "You crazy." He said, "Come on, I'll show you." So these two guys go to the top of this 22-story building. First guy said, "Watch me." And he sails off, and he gets down about the fourth floor, and he comes back and sits down and proves anything you ever seen. Second guy kind of shook his head and rubbed his eyes. Said, "I don't believe I saw that." First guy said, "You do it." He said, "No, you do it one more time, and let me be sure I think I saw what I think I saw." He said, "Well, watch close." He sails off again, gets down about the fourth floor, and he comes back and sits down and just proves anything you ever seen. He said, "I've done it twice now. You go ahead and try it." So the second guy decided he'd jump off. You know, he had fortified with some of that booze from down in the bar. So he sails off and splat, right on the sidewalk he went. Made a damn mess down there. First guy goes back down to the bar and bellies up to the bar, and the bartender comes up and sets a drink down in front of him and looks at him and said, "You know, Superman," said, "you're a son of a bitch when you drink." That about sums up my drinking career. I hurt a lot of people. I hurt a lot of people when I was drinking. Had a lot of amends to make. About the only people I had to put on my resentment list were about everybody I had ever known. Because if I had known you, I probably had hurt you in some way, talked about you, stole from you, done something to you. And I've done most of those amends, but I'll never get through making amends. I'll never finish that task as long as I live. If you don't believe me, read the 12 and 12. You know, I think it takes four things for me to have a program of alcoholics. I call it a philosophy for winning. And the first thing I got to have is discipline in my life. You know, the big book says that we are undisciplined people. And we let God discipline us in a way that has just been outlined. And that's in step 11. And so I got to have discipline in my life. I got to stop doing what I want to do and start doing what I'm supposed to do. You know, I had to go to a lot of meetings. And I asked my sponsor, I said, "How many meetings I got to go to a week?" He said, "How many nights a week you drink?" I said, okay. I didn't miss a night if I could help it. And so I go to a lot of meetings. That's about the only thing I done good the first year, is I went to a lot of meetings. In fact, I was so sick, you know what I did to impress you? I got me a little spiral notebook about that big. And every meeting I went to, I wrote down in that book where it was, which town it was, because I traveled 13 states, southeast and southwest. If I was in Dallas, Texas, and I went to a meeting, I'd write it down. If I was in Miami, Florida, I'd write it down. Louisville, Kentucky, I'd write it down. That first year, I went to 286 meetings around the country. I guess what I thought, that one of these days, Alcoholics Anonymous was going to come up with a pension plan, and me not knowing how many meetings I went, I might miss some benefits of that. But see how sick that is, so I can impress you with how many meetings I went to. And the next thing I got to have in my life is knowledge or wisdom. You know, I got to know what's in this book before I can give it to anybody else. I got to read and study this book. This is textbook. The textbook is for studying. You want a novel, you read a novel and you put it on the shelf, and if it's a real good novel, maybe 10 years later you might take it down and read it again. But a textbook is for studying, for learning. And that's what I'm still doing. And this is a magic book, by the way. Every time I read it, it changes. You know, something jumps off that page in that 164 pages. I know I've read it 100 times, but it didn't make an impression. See, I can't learn anything until I'm ready to receive it. But when I'm ready to receive it, God puts it in terms that I can comprehend it. And another thing I need in this program is unconditional love. I got to love you unconditionally. And I do. I love alcoholics because they're alcoholics. There's some of you I don't like, but I love you. And my contention is, if you like everybody in Alcoholics Anonymous, you ain't going to enough damn meetings. Okay? But it's not a person in him. It would call me at night that I wouldn't do something in some way to help him. It's unconditional love. And then the next thing I got to have, the fourth ingredient in this thing is surrender. Let go and let God. And I try to do that every morning when I get up and read my daily reflections at the bar in the kitchen. Over my coffee, I read my daily reflections like I did in the room this morning before we went out to play golf. And I ask God to help me get through this day without a drink, a mood-altering chemical, a cigarette, because I use this program to quit smoking on. 10 months after I quit drinking, I said, God, help me break this habit. And there's a sentence in our big book that says, quite as important was the discovery that spiritual principles will solve all my problems. So today when I have a problem, I just put that problem in the word alcohol in the first step and I can work the program on. I'm powerless over cigarettes in my life. See, I had to do that with my children the same way. 10 years after I got sober, my son got in a bunch of trouble with the police down in Washington County. And there was rifles and stuff involved, and it was a mess. And two nights in a row after that, my wife and I laying in the bed, and I got to feeling sorry for myself, you know, sitting on the pity pot. And I just said, if I had just been a better father, if I just hadn't have done this, if I hadn't have done that, little tears would roll out of my eyes, you know. The third night, see, I get what I need when I'm ready to handle it. The third night, I'm reading the grapevine. Now, I can't tell you what the rest of the story was about except one sentence in that grapevine. It says, hurt feelings are a disguised form of resentment. And the reason I had these hurt feelings is my son wouldn't run his life like I thought he ought to. The next morning, I got out on my knees, which I don't normally get on my knees because I got two artificial knees. And you don't get out on $30,000 artificial knees. Yeah. The only problem I have with them today, whenever my wife pushes the garage door with my legs fly out like that, that's all right. But the next morning, I got out on my knees and I said, God, these are your children too. You don't have any stepchildren or grandchildren, and I'm going to turn these children over to you. And I'd appreciate if you would take these hurt feelings away from me. And people, I stood up and those hurt feelings were gone. Now, I love those children unconditionally today because I don't have any expectation or prejudice standing in the way of that love I have for them. The boys are not much better. The boys are still doing that thing. But my daughter is recently coming into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous again. And I pray that she works these steps and gets a sponsor, that she will be able to stay sober one day at a time. Sponsorship, I think, is very important in this program. Everybody in here that's alcoholic got a sponsor? Don't raise your hand. I got a sponsor. About the kindest thing he ever said to me is, boy, I don't think you could make it. And that was just Tuesday of this week. You know what SPONSOR stands for? It's an acronym. A sober person offering newcomers suggestions on recovery. And that's all we do. It's when we have a sponsee, we get with this book, and we get with them, and we tell them what we did and how we did it. And hoping they'll come along for the ride. And they don't always do that. And that's unfortunate. I love to work with drunks. Because I are one of those drunks. And I love people to work for me. I got a couple of sponsees out of state that I've talked to just about every other night. I encourage them to get a sponsor in the town they live it in, but they still call me anyhow. And I work with these. And I call my sponsor. My sponsor saved my bacon a couple of times. I'm the only man I know that sobered up and like they got fired. You know, generally they want you to sober up so you can work. But see, my boss was my running buddy. We ran around the country calling on these companies and we drank and did other things together. I started to say chase women, but my wife might hear this tape. And I got sober. I got sober, and he wanted to fire me because he didn't like me the way I was. And our relationship was never the same again, but I worked another 12 and a half years for that company and retired 7.5 years ago, sober. I got in the program and started working with my sponsor, and he started leading me through the steps. And see, the way I'm going to tell you how I got to treatment. I was married to that wife again, and we was having a lot of trouble. She married me again the second time, and I was still drinking. But she thought she would, be able to straighten me out. And I'm on the road about 60-70% of the time, and I could drink a lot on the road. But there's one thing I never could understand. Is anybody in here with a telephone company? Nobody? That's unusual. But anyhow, I could never understand how she spent it over the telephone. I'd call home about 10 o'clock every night to get my message, and the first thing out of her mouth was, "You've been drinking." How in the hell did she know that? Well, we was having a lot of stuff to talk about my drinking. And I worked out of my house for 31 years. I didn't have an office to go to. And when I was home, I kind of moderated a little bit. But then I got to drinking. She knew the weekend it was drinking time. And then when I'm home, I've got to figure out how I can drink on Wednesday and then on the weekend. And then it got where I had to figure out how I could drink on Tuesday, Wednesday, and the weekend. And she knew I was going to drink on the weekend. That was a given. So we got to sending me to hypnotherapist and psychiatrist. Anybody in here been hypnotized? Let me see your hands on this one. It's a trip, ain't it? It's a trip. I loved it. I went to this hypnotherapist. She came home one day and she said, "You know, some people at the office want to quit smoking, and they go into this hypnotherapist, and he suggests to them they don't do this stuff, and they're not doing it. They quit smoking." She said, "I think it works on drinking too. You ought to go." So to buy some drinking time, I went to the hypnotherapist. And we were living in Smyrna, up close to Atlanta. And every Friday afternoon at 3 o'clock, I was out at his office. Had a nice couch, low lights. And he'd do his thing on me, you know. Boy, was it like the world was lifted off my shoulders. I just felt loose as a goose. I'd come out of there, tiptoe down them steps, and get in my car and get on Peachtree and Delta Boulevard, get on 285 going back to Smyrna with all them damn Friday afternoon traffic, and get home and have to have a drink for all that damn mess I'd been through that afternoon. That went on for about 4 or 5 months, and of course, you know, it didn't work. Then we got me a psychiatrist at the Medical College of Georgia over in Augusta. And when I went in there, I got teed off right quicker, that thing. She didn't even have a couch. Now, who ever heard of a psychiatrist not having a couch in the office? Every movie I've ever seen had a psychiatrist with a couch and everything. But she didn't. She had two chairs at a 45-degree angle, a little table in the middle with an ashtray on it. But over on this wall is a big mirror. I said, "Lady, is that a two-way mirror?" She said, "Yes." "We film these sessions so we can train our medical students." "Right." You think she got the right answer? She got the answer I thought she wanted. Of course, that didn't work either. Then in 1983, my wife, she picked up a bad habit then. She got to leaving home. She'd leave, rent an apartment somewhere, just go somewhere. She couldn't hang in there. We started having a lot of trouble about this drinking thing. And I didn't see what the damn problem was myself. She just couldn't understand my drinking is what was wrong. Well, we got to having a lot of discussion about it. And then this is in 1980, we had a chance to buy a lake house down in Millersville. And me and a traveling salesman, I can live anywhere I want to, as long as I can get to the airport on Monday morning. So we bought a lake house down in Millersville. We moved to the lake. And she thought if she got me down there with a nice, serene, calm setting, I wouldn't have to drink so much. Well, people, when you get on the lake, there's a reason to party every night. If it ain't one, you invent it. And, of course, the drinking picked up and discussions about my drinking picked up. And it was loud in my house. Now, the first time we were married, there was physical and mental abuse in this marriage. She'd haul off and slap me knowing she didn't get hit back. And she said she was just that kind of person. See, I tell you, these people are sick. And she's about 5'2", and I'm about 6'2". And that alone tells you ain't going to win most of the time, unless you got a 12-gauge shotgun like she had one night. And I'll tell you about that. And so we got this house down in Millersville on the lake, and we moved down there. Well, it really picked up then, the noise. But I became a breaker. I wouldn't hit her because she told me one time after we started. See, she watched me drink for 3.5 years after we started going back together to see if I had it down right, if I could drink. She never wanted me not to drink. She wanted me to drink like she wanted me to drink. And I didn't want to drink like her because she wanted me to have two. And that won't get it. So anyhow, I want to digress a little bit. The reason we got divorced the first time, and a lot of physical, mental, emotional abuse. And it culminated in one night, I told her to get in the car. We had got out of the Army, and I was going to University of Georgia. It was my senior year, University of Georgia. And I told her, get in the car. And she knew what was happening. I take her for a ride. I get in that car, and I just ride out down the highway, just flying down. I cut donuts in the middle of the road, and ride through the woods. I was a maniac with an automobile. We had a 56 Chevrolet convertible. And I told her, I said, get in the car. And when I walked out the door, she slammed the door, and the night latch caught. And when it did, I turned around and busted the glass out with my left hand, undone the night latch, walked in, and she was standing 28 foot across that living room, because later on I measured it. And she had run in the bedroom and grabbed a single barrel 12 gauge shotgun, and she was standing 28 foot across that living room, that thing cocked and pointed at me. And see, I got my liquor in me now. I got my courage in me. I'm bulletproof and invincible. I walk across that living room, and the barrel is sticking right here, and I look her in the eye, and I said, pull the trigger, put the damn gun down. And she moved it away from my chest. I said, let me have the gun, and she let me take it away from her. I turned around, and I slapped her and said, next time you pull the damn trigger, and I went to the hospital and had my hand sewed up. Well, a few days later, God is doing for her what she couldn't do for herself. She got courage enough to leave me. She left me my last quarter at the University of Georgia, and we got a divorce. And I didn't mess with her. She said she slept with a gun on her pillow for 2 years, afraid I might knock on her door some night. That's how scared that woman was of me, the way I had treated her. But I didn't mess with her. Then she got to marrying alcoholics. She married two in the meantime, and in a few years, I'm up in Atlanta one day. She was working in Atlanta. I called it off. I said, let's have coffee. And she met me at a coffee, at a restaurant for coffee, and we talked for a few minutes. Then I'm back up for working in Atlanta one day, and I called her and said, let's have lunch. She said, I don't know if I want to have lunch with you or not. I said, well, you pick the place, and I'll meet you. She picked the Midnight Sun. It was right down in Peachtree City, one of the most expensive places you could eat in Atlanta. So we met there for lunch, and we sitting there talking, having a beer. And I said, when did you leave your husband? She said, I hadn't left him. I said, you're a liar. You have left him. She said, how do you know that? I said, only four people in this world know, him, me, my mother, and daddy. I said, it's very simple. You know, we're not dumb. My mother and daddy and her mother and daddy live four houses apart in Sandersville, Georgia. Okay? And she's home the last two weekends before this in her own personal car. She never came home in her personal car. They always came in his company car so it wouldn't cost him anything. And she says, yeah, I left. And I said, well, I want to start dating you again. She says, I don't know where I want to date you or not. I said, well, that's good. I said, I'm going to Texas Monday morning. I'm coming back in Friday. I'll call you at work. If you want to go out, we'll go out. And we started going out again. It wasn't long before we were just seeing each other constantly. I was staying at her apartment on the weekend. And we would get along pretty good. And we were sitting there one Friday night having a beer before we went out. And she said, I want to tell you something. She said, you're the only man that ever put a hand on me. She said, my daddy never even spanked me when I was a little girl. She said, neither one of my other husbands have ever hit me. And she said, well, I want to tell you something. You big son of a bitch, you ever hit me again, I'll kill you in your sleep. And I never got drunk enough to forget that, man. She's got three pistols, got a pistol-toting permit, and she knows how to shoot. She's been shooting all her life. Now, I'd get so mad at her sometime, I want to knock her through the wall. And I'd draw back and say, I can't sleep here tonight. They have a way of getting your attention. And she meant it. Anybody that knows her, and a few ladies in this audience, knows she's a little spitfire. And she's a great Al-Anon, I guarantee you. And I think she's done a marvelous job as delegate for Al-Anon. Anyhow, thank y'all. We moved to the lake, started partying, drinking picked up, noise level picked up. I'm breaking coffee pots and blenders, knocking down doors, kicking furniture apart, not touching her. And she got tired of this stuff, and then at the end of the first of January of 1983, I called home from Texas that Monday night to get my messages. Just before the days of cell phones and pagers and all that. I used to call home about 10 o'clock every night to get all my messages for the day. And she answered the telephone. As soon as she said hello, I knew something was wrong. I said, what's the matter? She says, I just thought you might like to know I ain't going to be here when you get home. I moved out. What's the matter, baby? Is she drinking? Oh, I'll quit. See, I'm good at quitting. When Sergey and I got divorced the first time, do you know I quit drinking? For 5.5 years, I didn't touch anything else. Just to show her it wasn't liquor that caused us to get divorced. I married my second wife for 3 years before she ever sees me take a drink, and 3 years later, we're divorced because she's tired of my drinking. I quit drinking for 19 months. I found that my problem wasn't quitting. My problem was I couldn't stop starting again. And I think the reason I could quit for periods of time, I always knew there was a drink down the road. And I told her that night, I said, I'll quit for a while. She said, I've taken this place for months, and we'll talk about it after a month. If you've been doing pretty good, well, I might come home. She moved back in, and we started playing house again, you know, and everything. And I'd go out and work in the yard, be sweating, hot, come in. I said, baby, you wouldn't mind if I had a beer, would you? She said, oh, my, no. I would never mind if you could have one or two. See, she didn't know anything about alcoholism either. Well, I'd have one or two today and one or two tomorrow. And I remember one afternoon coming in and wasn't any beer in the refrigerator. So I got my billfold, started to, where are you going? I said, I'm going to the beer store. Just relax, baby. I'm going to the beer store to get the beer. I said, I promise. I ain't going to have but two beers today. And she kind of relaxed, and I come walking back through the door with a quart in each hand. She didn't think it was funny at all. But it wasn't long before I'm back on my hard liquor, and the noise level picking up, and she's threatening to leave, and I'm quitting, and we're trying to play house. And I don't know how to play house. I really don't. I'm not equipped to be a father or a husband. I'm equipped to be a drunk. And I can sell. That's one talent I had. I can sell stuff. Everybody's selling something. I don't care what you're doing, you're selling something. Selling yourself, selling time or something. But I was pretty good at what I was doing. Making more money than I ever made in my life. Had a nice place to live, nice car. And she'd call me an alcoholic, and I said, can't be alcoholic. See, I didn't know what one was. I thought I knew what one was. I used to try to pick her up at Kane Tower in Peachtree Center up uptown on Kane Street up there. And I'd drive up sometime to get her, and I'd see these drunks staggering down the street with an overcoat on in the summertime, the front of the pants are wet, and they got on yellow tennis shoes. And to me, that was an alcoholic. And I'm not an alcoholic. She said, you're an alcoholic. And I said, you're crazy as hell. I said, I've never had a DUI. I've never been in jail. I got a house, a car, a job, money in the bank, and I don't drink in the daytime. I only drink from 5 o'clock on. Kind of steady my nerves after a hard day's work. You know what I mean? Got so steady sometime I couldn't move. And never took a morning drink. Never took a morning drink. I would die. They can go to hell before I take a morning drink, because alcoholics drink in the morning. And I wasn't an alcoholic. Couldn't be. Just because I drank a quart of liquor from 5 o'clock to 8:30 at night and topped it off with 6 PBR beers, I wasn't. That was doing the weekend. On the weekend, we done some serious drinking. I didn't see the problem. I just couldn't see the problem. But she did. So one night, I started towards the refrigerator one Sunday night to get my daily rations. It was 5 o'clock. It's time to drink. And I kept my liquor in the freezer tray of the refrigerator. It don't freeze. It just kind of gets syrupy and pulls slow and kind of cuts through some of that old rotten taste. I drank those cheap ancient age. Now, I know it's cheap liquor. But by this time, see, I'm throwing up a lot. If you throw up something like Crown Royal, that's almost a sacrilege. You throw up over ancient age, you ain't lost much, you know what I mean? And I started towards the refrigerator to get my daily rations, and she looked at me and she said, will you give me one day in 2 weeks that you don't get drunk? I gave her night, and I sold up and went sat in my drunk chair, and I wouldn't talk to this wench that night. She'd say something to me. I said, yeah, no, maybe. And, of course, Monday it was kind of cool around the house. And 5 o'clock came, and I started towards the refrigerator to get my daily rations. And I get it, and she give me that. I come to term this look, and I'm sure some of you alcoholics have had this look from the wife. I call it the thin lip look. That head kind of cocks to the side, and them lips get thin and purple. And they look at you. And I put my finger in her face. I said, don't you say anything to me tonight. I gave you your night last night. And I proceeded to get out of my bottle of courage. And about 7 o'clock, I went into getting me another drink. And it was about half empty. And she gave me that thin lip look again, and I put my finger in her face. I said, why don't you get out of my life? You are my problem. I can't even come home and have a couple of drinks without you raising hell about it. I'd be much, much better off if you'd leave. And she said, I'd leave, but you might try to stop me. I said, that's all you're worried about. I'd get you an escort. I called the sheriff's office. I said, I'm having a few drinks, and my wife's a little upset and wants to leave. Would you send a deputy out here to escort her off of my property? He said, sir, we don't like to get involved in domestic disputes. Can't you handle this yourself? I said, thank you. I hung up and I picked it up and I called the sheriff directly at his home. He's my ex-brother-in-law. Louis, I'm having a little trouble. You sent it. He sent two. And I invited him in, offered him a drink. And she went in there and packed a bag. If there'd been an event in the Olympics for backpacking, she'd have won a gold medal. She got that backpack and she was in that car and she was gone. And when I saw the lights go over the hill in the back of the house, I felt good. That goes my damn problem. I can do what I want to from now on. See, there's only one thing about getting drunk and passing out the night before. That's coming to the next morning. You know, most people wake up. Alcoholic comes to. Looks like a deer on the expressway at rush hour. So I came through the next morning and I knew I had made a big mistake. So I called her in Atlanta. I knew where she'd be. She was two friends of ours up there. And she wasn't going to talk to me, but Beverly made her talk to me. And I said, baby, how about coming on back home? She said, nope, not on your life, not unless you get some professional help. Now, people don't ever ask this next question unless you want the answer, because they got the answer for you. Do you know where I can get this help? Oh, hell, she knew. Yes, sir, she knew. And the reason she knew this man's name is she had checked her father in the state hospital A&D ward for the 14th time in 3 years. He was an alcoholic. And she was standing at the elevator on the third floor of the power building, and she was crying at the time she checked him in for the 14th time. And this fella came out and started talking to her, said, look, you need somebody to talk to, come in my office. And he was the director of this A&D program. And she told him about her father, and then she told him about me. And he said, well, if you ever need me, and he gave her a 24-hour number where he could be reached. And this is the number she gave me. She said, why don't you call this man? Maybe he'll help you. And I called him, and that morning, after I hung up with her, I called him that morning, and he said, come out at 3 o'clock this afternoon and talk to me. I said, okay. And I called her back in Atlanta. I said, babe, you can come on home now. I got an appointment at 3 o'clock this afternoon. She said, nope, you make your appointment, and then we'll talk. Well, I went out there, and I talked with Jim. And he convinced me to go to treatment. Now, I wasn't an alcoholic, but I went to get my wife back. And so I said I'd go to treatment. But I couldn't go before December the 5th. I couldn't check in that treatment center before December the 5th. And this was on a Tuesday. And December the 5th was Monday. So I said, I can't, Jim. I can't. He said, well, we'll take you over there tomorrow. And I know. No, can't go before December the 5th. The reason I couldn't go was I was on the board of directors for my company, and we had our annual meeting on December the 5th to vote on the bonuses for Christmas and stuff, and I had to be at that meeting. It was very important for me to be at that meeting. See, I was an important kind of person, you know. And so I went up to Atlanta on Wednesday and talked to my wife. I said, will you come home? She said, I'll be home this weekend. I'll come home Saturday afternoon. We'll pack your bag Sunday. You go to your meeting Monday. We'll drop you off treatment Monday night. I said, fine. Now, nobody told me I had to stop drinking when I went to treatment. That wasn't mentioned. So, anyhow, on Friday night, December 2nd, 1983, I called her in Atlanta and I said, baby, you coming home tomorrow? She said, I'll be home after lunch. I said, it's going to be good to have you home. And it's about 4:45 now, see. I said, it's going to be good to have you home. And I hung up that telephone and walked straight to the refrigerator and opened that freezer and got me out another brand new filth of age at age. And I drank it that night. Topped it off with those beers, 6 PBR beers. See, I didn't think anything was wrong with that. If she didn't know about it, how could it hurt? Well, there must have been something wrong with it, because the next morning I got up and I cleaned up our house and sprayed about 3 cans of aerosol spray all over the house and took all the chasers and bottles to the dump. And she came home Saturday afternoon. We packed my bag Sunday. I went to my meeting Monday, dropped me off at treatment in Alabama on Monday night. And when I was talking to Jim that day, he said, there's a treatment center down in Statesboro, Georgia. Nope, I ain't going now. See, I knew two fellows from Sandersville that had gone there, and they were still drinking, so in my pea brain, that wasn't any good. Then he named one in Atlanta. I said, nope, don't want to go to that one either. Didn't want to go any, have anything to do with Atlanta because I lived up there. I didn't like it. Then he named one over in Alabama, and the name of it was Brookwood Lodge. I said, yeah. Sounds like my kind of place. Had a ring. Brookwood Lodge. I'll take my golf clubs, fishing tackle, and tennis racket, and I go to treatment. They said, no, you leave those things home. And I got in that treatment center, and they started talking about abstinence. Abstinence. I said, I got a question. I said, doesn't abstinence mean that you don't do it at all? They said, right. I said, damn, this is severe. I did not see how I could function without my booze, because it had been a part of me for so long. In the doctor's opinion, it says men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. To me, that's an understatement. I love the effect produced by alcohol. They said, while they admit it is injurious, they cannot after time differentiate the truth from the false. To them, the alcoholic life seems like the only normal one. That was normal for me, was to get drunk, raise hell, and not know what I did. I was a blackout drinker. I had them when they first came out. And I think these Al-Anons, if they know you don't remember the night before, they add to that story a little bit, because I couldn't have done all them things you said. I couldn't have done all that mess. I'm okay. And she never would wake me up, my wife would never wake me up to talk about what happened the night before, because I did not know. I didn't know whether it was going to be a door knocked down, a window missing, a blender broke, a coffee pot smashed. And she would pull her chair upside the bed, and she'd be sitting there with a cup of coffee and cigarette waiting for me to wake up. And when you got a hangover and you wake up and look at that, you know, you don't like it. I'd wake up and she'd be sitting there, and the first thing out of her mouth is, did you mean what you said last night? Now, how in the hell am I supposed to know what I said last night? So my retaliatory question to her was, what did you think I said last night? And then she would tell me what she thought I said, and I said, no, you took that all wrong. This is what I meant. See, I had to get out of that stuff. Tell me we can't con, manipulate, and cheat these people. And this went on year after year after year. But I went to that treatment center, and I got in there, and I was in there 5 days. And they started talking about feelings. They didn't talk about what we did when we were drinking. They talked about how we felt before we drank and after we drank. And I started identifying with these feelings they were talking about. The feelings of low self-esteem, how that left. Feelings of inadequacy, how that left. Feelings of fear, how that left. And I drank to feel better. I drank to not feel the pain of living sober the way I was living. That's the reason I drank. I drank so the promises would come true in my life. And I started identifying that I was an alcoholic. That Friday night, I called home. We had phone privileges. We had a window between 7 and 8 o'clock. And depending on how many people were going to call that night, you had so many minutes. We had a clock you set. And as soon as that, if it hit 7 minutes and went off, you had to hang up the telephone. You tell your people this before you get on the phone. That night, I think I had about 10 minutes to talk with her. And when she answered the telephone, I said, guess what? She said, what? I said, I'm a damn alcoholic. And she started crying. I said, what are you crying about? She said, I'm so glad you know what you are. Maybe you can do something about it. I hadn't had to drink since. Because of God and the program Alcoholics Anonymous. See, God led me to AA, and AA led me to my God. And my God's got me through a lot of things since I've been in this program. And he continues to do that. See, I always believed in God, you know, just in case there was one. And I used to listen to those Baptist preachers pounding, pointing, pointing the finger. See, if you think about it, you're going to hell. If you do it, you're going to hell, and God's going to get you for that. Why is God going to get me, preacher? Because he loves you. Didn't understand that. And if I'm going to hell for thinking it, I might as well do it. Now, I know somewhere along the line, some preacher somewhere told me that God loved me. But I didn't hear that. I heard God was going to get me, and I was scared of God. So as soon as I could, I stopped going to church, except when I needed some help. I'd send up a 911 prayer every once in a while. You know, God, if you just get me out of this trouble, I swear I'd go to church 3 weekends in a row. He didn't get me out of trouble, and I didn't go to church 3 weekends in a row. But I always believed there was one, like I said, just in case there was one. But there's a difference between believing in God and trusting in God. The big book says, trust God and clean house. But I believe the first three steps is trust God. 4 through 11 is clean house. And 12 is help others. And I trust my God today. My God's been good to me. God is good. Good is God. If it ain't good, it ain't from God, is the way I feel today. But there was one sentence in the big book that threw me for a long time. It was in the old Dr. Alcoholic Addict story that's been retitled in the new 4th edition, Acceptance Was the Answer. Dr. Paul wrote it. It says, nothing happens in God's world by mistake. That threw me for a long time. Because what about war and famine and pestilence and stuff like that? Nothing happens in God's world by mistake. And I had the opportunity to talk with Dr. Paul about this at a conference up in Cashiers, North Carolina. And he said that if he could change anything in that book, he'd make it a little bit more clear. It's true that nothing happens in God's world by mistake, but a whole hell of a lot happens in man's world by mistake. And that's the difference. And it cleared it up for me. Today, my God is kind, loving, forgiving, understanding, wanting the best for me. And that's what the big book said. I get to choose my own concept of God. See, when I got to that third step, it says, we made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. And see, I don't think we take the first two steps. At least the big book says we don't. After we read the ABCs, A, God could, we were alcoholic, could I manage our own lives? B, that no human power can relieve our alcoholism. C, that God could and would if he was sought. The very next sentence in that book says, being convinced, we are at step 3, and a step 3 is italicized. And every time you get to a step thereafter, it'll be italicized. So I don't think we take step 1 and 2. We become convinced that we are alcoholic, our life is unmanageable, and a power greater than ourselves is going to restore us to sanity. How we become convinced of that? By reading the first part of that book, the doctor's opinion and Bill's story tells us what the problem is. We have an allergy to the body coupled with obsession in the mind. When we take that first drink, we trigger that obsession to drink, and we keep drinking. Chapter 2, 3, and 4, there's a solution more about alcoholism, and we agnostics gives us the solution, not the answer. I had been told to answer in all my life, don't drink. That's the answer. But the big book says there's a solution, and thank God it is. And the solution is a power greater than myself. Now, the third step, I can choose that power, and I didn't know that. Made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as we understood him. I think when we make a decision in that third step, we're making a decision to work step 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9 so we'll be able to turn our life over to God and our will. And what is your life and what is your will? That's what I ask. And they told me this way. Said, if you was to go to a lawyer today and he takes your thoughts and he puts them on a piece of paper, when you die, you want your wife all to have this, thus, and so that you own. What does he call that? He takes your thoughts and he puts them on a piece of paper. I said, a will. He said, okay, your will is no more than you're thinking. He said, what's your life? He said, how about your everyday actions? You get up in the morning, you take a shower, you put on your clothes, you go to work, go to a meeting, go to a movie, go to out to the restaurant. So what you're making a decision to do is turning your thinking and your actions over to God's care. When you first get here, your thinking ain't worth a damn, so your actions ain't worth a damn. So you can't think your way into sober living, you got to live your way into sober thinking. And how you do that? By working this program day in and day out, over and over and over again. And I've still got a long way to go. I'm still learning how to live in this program. Bill Wilson called it a design for living that really works. And that's what it's shown me, how to live in this program sober one day at a time. You know, one time there was a bunch of people wandering in the desert over in Egypt somewhere. And God said, I'm going to give you manna every day so you won't starve to death. But you can't store it up except on the weekend you get 2 servings. And some people didn't take him for his word. And they would try to hoard that stuff. They'd get up more than they could eat that day. And every day it was spoiled on them. But as long as they had faith that it would be there, it was there. Now I know my God is there today. Because I trust my God today. That son of mine got in a bunch of trouble. Well, let me tell you first about my son-in-law. 1992, he came to me. He said, Mr. Bex, Teresa and I are drinking too much, and will you help us? Yes, Donald will. I took him to Jim, the guy to help me. He put him in an inpatient treatment, put my daughter in outpatient. And they got sober for a few months. They started coming to the program. But then they made a decision they didn't need us anymore. So they stopped coming. And I saw very little of them, except at the holidays when they'd come around for the presents and stuff. And I didn't get into it with them because they knew where the help was. Then my son got in trouble. I told you about that, with the guns and all. And I told you why I got out on my knees and turned them over to God. I learned how to do that, surrender these people to God. And now my daughter's back in the program. And I'm hoping she'll stay this time. The grace of God, she will. There was a little Jesuit priest. I'm going to close with this story. There was a little Jesuit priest in St. Louis that read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Actually, it wasn't a big book. He read a manuscript of the big book. And he wanted to help the drunks in St. Louis. He was a Jesuit priest, and he didn't have a drinking problem. So he got on a train and went to New York to see Bill Wilson, who wrote most of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And this is in Pass It On. And the right way I came about this story is I'm 4 years sober. 4 years and 2 months to be exact sober. I call it sobriety. I'm not sober, but I'm dry, you know. I think sober is a state of mind where you're happy, joyous, and free. And my wife and I get up one morning, you know, going to a surrender week down at Epworth by the sea. And she said something to me I didn't like that morning, and I jogged back at her, and she jogged back at me, and we got a dialogue going. It wasn't very, very pleasant in that car. And we fussing all the way down there. We get out in the Hazelhurst. I said, I ought to put you out. She said, find a bus station. I get out. Well, she didn't, and we made it on in silence to Epworth by the sea, and I got down there, and my sponsor happened to be there. He wasn't supposed to be there. He was there, and of course, I told him about her. And he says, you're reading Pass It On, aren't you? I said, yeah, I am. He said, where are you at in that book? I said, about page 150. He said, well, go get that book down and read around 246 and come back and we'll talk. Well, this is when the story about the little Jesuit priest come into being. He goes to New York City and he finds Bill Wilson in the old 24th Street clubhouse one cold winter night in 1940. Bill Wilson called it a conversation that lasted for 20 years. And you see, Bill Wilson had been sober since December of 34, but he had never taken his fifth step. So he took his fifth step with Father Ed Dowling that night. But when it was over, he said to Father Ed, I still have anger and doubt and frustration in my life. Won't it ever get any better? And Father Ed Dowling shot back at him and says, blessed are they who hunger and thirst. He said, God's children are never satisfied with where they are at. And because of their divine dissatisfaction, they'll always be striving for more. And when I found out I wasn't going to be all right, I was okay. When I found out that no matter how long I live, I'm going to have problems in my life. The big book says it, continue to watch out for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. When these crop up, we ask God to remove them when we talk with someone immediately. So no matter how long I stay here, I'll have problems every once in a while in my life. But I don't call them problems anymore. I call them opportunities to grow. And that's what this program has given me. And this little crippled Jesuit priest used to talk to audiences about Alcoholics Anonymous. He'd go out and he'd tell them all about Alcoholics Anonymous. And he used to say, folks, this AA is good. Come and get it. Thank you.